I want to start off by thanking the committee for asking me to participate here today. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak always. I want to thank Wendy, Larry, Rick, and Amy for allowing us all to come here this weekend and enjoy the Salmon Arm Roundup. It's been a great weekend so far. I thoroughly enjoyed the young people's panel that we heard last night when we arrived here. And Kevin O from Kamloops gave a great talk last night. We really enjoyed it. And then afterwards, we had karaoke, and I had no idea that so many people from Alcoholics Anonymous could sing. Like, we stayed here late, and we laughed. And I have one friend from our district, and I said, "You tricked me. I thought you were shy. I always thought you were shy." You know, and here she's up here just belting it out. So what a phenomenal talk. And our old-timer panel today, you know, thank you to you guys as well for sharing. It's been wonderful so far. I look up at the theme, humility, and I was like, oh, how do you talk on that? And then I remember back to my phone call from Larry, and Larry called me up and asked me to tell my story. So I'm going to stick to that. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and people hear me say that all the time, and I usually start sharing with that I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I mean it from the core of my soul. I have a love for this fellowship and our three legacies that it runs deep. You guys know that about me, because Alcoholics Anonymous changes people. This fellowship, these 12 steps, and God gave me a brand new life. I didn't change my old life. I got a brand new life coming here. And I continue to receive that brand new life so long as I'm willing to follow the directions on our basic text and keep my big book open and just keep going to it and keep following the directions over and over and over again. I was talking to my sister, LaVon, on my way up here this morning, and we were talking about... I was telling her about a couple of events in my life, and I said, I think I'm going to talk about those things today because I never do, because there's pain. And she goes, oh, Dad and I are so sensitive. You know, Dad and I, we're Pisces, and we just cry about everything. She says, you've always been so strong. I said, it's not that I'm strong. I'm more like Mom, and I stuffed it. I just stuffed feelings my whole life, and I never wanted to feel. So it's not that I'm strong. It's that I stuffed it. And I remember when I was preparing for what I was going to say here today, and part of my preparation was to just write down a couple little notes about those two painful things, and I could just feel it right here. So, you know, after a little bit of time, I'm starting to feel, and I'm grateful for that. What I know for sure, the woman that I am today, standing up here, giving this talk, has changed. From the woman that I was last year, or the year before that. Because you see, my perception changes all the time. How I see things, how I act, how I react, how I see you and how I see myself. So the talk I give today is going to be a talk about my perception right now, how I see things right now, and it's different from last year. One of the things I know for sure is that my childhood, as I see it today, is much different than how I saw my childhood when I was brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was talking to my sponsor last week when we were in Arizona, and how we see our parents and our upbringing, and we agreed wholeheartedly that our perceptions changed on how we see that today than how we saw it when we were new. As a newcomer, I saw my parents, and they were drinkers, and they made all these mistakes, and my mom was cold, and she didn't give me any feelings, and as I grow in AA and I change and I make my own mistakes, I find myself more compassionate about my parents and understanding of others, especially my family. So if I gave a talk when I was new in AA, my childhood was difficult, and today I see it that they did the very best they could with what they had. And I look back at how my parents were raised, and I take those things into consideration now. I grow and change in AA by making corrections to who I am. I act, think, and react with the steps we're self-correcting in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I make a lot of mistakes, and thankfully I can make corrections to those mistakes and set right my wrongs as I go along. often I do the wrong thing first in order to do the right thing. It's been the story of my life, right? I make a mistake, I correct it, I change who I am. So speaking of mistakes, our fellowship made its fair share of mistakes in the early days. The trial and error experience of our earliest members helped to determine what works for our groups, relations with the general public, and AA as a whole. Thankfully, we're self-correcting, and our 12 traditions keep us spiritually united. The traditions start out by saying, AA experience has taught us, and I love that. So when I think about the traditions and how we see them, it's a very different set of principles and how corporations and nonprofits in our world operate. Imagine I'm talking to a non-alcoholic, and he's asking me about our fellowship. And the man says to me, he goes, so how do you raise money for AA? Oh, we don't take any outside money. We're self-supporting through the voluntary contributions of our own members. Well, what about your membership requirements? Oh, we don't have any of those. The only requirements for membership is a desire to stop drinking. So who's in charge? Who governs AA? God. As he expresses himself in our group conscience, our leaders are servants. Nobody governs. Well, you guys must do a lot of promotion. Oh, no. We rely on attraction, actually, rather than promotion. We don't do any promotion. Well, what does AA think about, whoa, we have no opinion on outside issues. We don't want to engage in any controversy. And I laugh when I look at our traditions in this way, because to a non-alcoholic, it sounds backwards. But for us, well, we stay spiritually united. So like our traditions, I've learned to be self-correcting through the 12 steps, which is our program of recovery, but it wasn't easy. I think the line in the book, big book, that at some of these we balked, we thought we could find an easier, softer way, that was written for me. I was a balker, big time. It took me a real long time to finally come in here and join you guys. I like to call myself a spectator in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a spectator for 8 years. And the reason I call myself a spectator is because I would come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I would just sit down as a spectator and I would observe you guys and I would watch what you were saying. It's kind of like a person coming to an open meeting. I would just sit down and I would listen to you and, oh, that sounded really good. And I remember driving home in my car and I would think about what I'd heard and I'm going to apply this to my life and this to my life. But I didn't join anything. I didn't join a group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have a home group. I didn't do anything that was suggested. I would just take these little inspirational things that I heard. And I did that for 8 years. I really was a spectator. That's exactly what I was. I also know the price of admission to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know how to finally walk through that door desperate, cornered, completely defeated. I know that. And ready to take, finally ready to take direction from another female member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I remember being a little kid and feeling like I didn't quite fit in. I had this emptiness about me. I wasn't adequate. I didn't have the same tools as you guys did for life. It's like you guys had a manual for life, and I didn't have that same manual. I spent a lot of time comparing to how I felt to how you guys looked. It seemed like everyone paired up with best friends and in groups, and I didn't seem to have that. I was a lonely introvert kind of a kid. And I can tell you, I've seen this on almost every single fears list that I've looked at, including my own, and it's four words. I'm not good enough. Some people call it low self-worth or lack of self-esteem, but it's all the same thing, and I've seen it on every single list that I've looked at. So I remember my first drunk, and it was also my first drink. I got blackout drunk at my first attempt drinking. I went up the mountain road with a bunch of teenagers, and I was in grade 7, so I was probably 12. And in my mind, those kids were better than me. And in my mind, they didn't want to talk to me. I was by myself, and they were with their group, and they're laughing and smiling and having fun, and I'm by myself. I could tell I didn't fit with them. So I went over to this jug of red wine. In those days, they used to have these gallons of red wine in a green bottle with a little round handle on the top. It was one of those. people are laughing. I can hear some people have seen those bottles. And there was a measuring cup there, and I filled it up with red wine, and I didn't just sip it, I downed it really, really fast. And I had a couple of those. And pretty soon I looked around at those people in those groups, and they wanted to talk to me. It's like, oh, now they want to talk to me. And I went over them, and I joined them, and I was part of the party, and I remember laughing and enjoying the people and drinking more out of the measuring cup that night. And what booze did for me that night to make me feel a part of, well, the part I remember. I got blackout drunk. I remember my mom coming into the bathroom about 3 a.m, and her and my dad were arguing, and there's red wine puke all over the place. And they're going, she's drunk. She's drunk. And mom's like, it's red wine, I can smell it. And she's cleaning me up, and I'm trying to pretend I'm sleeping now. And she put me in my bed, and I woke up the next morning, and she's on the floor, and I kind of snuck out because our class had a field trip to Stanley Park that day. And I'm in grade 7, and everyone's on the field trip looking at stuff, and I'm behind cedar trees puking over and over. It was awful. But even with the hangover and the throwing up and all of that stuff, what booze did for me, that was a small price to pay for the feeling I got and the fitting in that I was going to get when I drank, and I couldn't wait to do it again. I agree with Bill Wilson when he writes in his story, I was part of life at last. That's how I felt with alcohol. You know, so you go to school, and in school you find the friends that drink like you do or that are from families like you do, and you hook up and you form little groups, and that's how it goes, and that's what I did. I found the other kids that were alkies. I remember being excited in school about Wednesday, because when Friday came we were going to be able to drink, and everything was planned around drinking. As a kid, I'm starting to plan my life around drinking, and I'm in elementary school, or in high school. I don't have this huge long drunkalogue, but I'm going to tell you about a couple of events that happened in my life when I was a young lady that affected my life and contributed to a lot of remorse and pain, and I drank over those things when I was a kid. And I haven't really talked about them much before, and I'll mention them a little bit today. One of them, when I was 16, I was an alcoholic teenager. I drank all the time. And I used to show horses, and I wanted to show horses in this barn, because the trainer in that barn had taken kids to the nationals and they'd won, and I aspired to be able to ride at that level. What I didn't know going into that barn was that he was a pedophile. And he used to get me drunk and take me to hotels and do things to me that 16-year-old girls shouldn't experience. I was too young to experience the things sexually that this man imposed upon me. And I went through that time not realizing the pain I was in at the time, but afterwards, and rethinking it, and the remorse I felt like it was my fault was so painful that my alcoholism really sped up at that time, because I had so much pain and I wasn't equipped to deal with that. So now I'm drinking because I don't like how I feel in a sober state, so I'm drinking as much as I can. And I went on like that through grade 12. I barely graduated from high school. I was a mess as a teenager. I knew as a teenager that I'd crossed that imaginary line from being a regular drinker into alcoholism. I remember knowing that day. I just knew inside me. I didn't know how serious alcoholism was, but I knew I was alcoholic. I started to work at a strip bar when I was 18. I wasn't a stripper, I was a waitress. I'll just clarify that. And I would zoom around at the tables, and I was in a strip bar, so it was a bar full of men. And at that time, I thought self-esteem was the attention I was getting from the men in the bar. It's the weird, the things that you think when you're a kid. You know, I thought that was self-esteem. I liked the attention the job brought with it, and the best part of it is that I could drink at work. You know, and my daily drinking began, and I drank shooters at work. People would buy me shooters, and I would drink shooters at the work. I started my day with drinks, and I drank all through the day. And it was the perfect job for a young alcoholic female. But I still had the pain, you know, I still had the pain. And I remember seeing TV commercials and watching movies, and you see mothers with little babies and they're so happy, right? They've got this child and they're playing and everybody's happy and there's all this joy. So I thought, you know, maybe if I have a baby, the child will bring me joy. And I really thought that. I really thought that a child would bring me joy. So I planned with this boyfriend that I had at the time to have a baby. I just thought it was a great idea. It was going to make me happy. It was going to be the thing that fixed me. So when I was 23 years old, I gave birth to a little girl. And I remember, this is a God thing. When I was pregnant, I knew I was carrying a handicapped child, and no test ever told me that. I had an inner knowing. And I gave birth to this little girl, and the scene in the delivery room was exactly how it was in my mind. I give birth to the baby, and the doctors look at the baby, and the doctors look at me, and they look at the baby, and they're like, I'm very sorry to tell you, but your child is handicapped. And it kind of went down that way. The specialist came in, looked at her, and looked at me, and looked at her, and the facial resemblances didn't really all match, and they said, I'm sorry, but your baby has some sort of a syndrome, and we're going to have to take her away for some testing. And I hadn't drank for 9 months. No, it's not true. I had a couple beers when I was pregnant. When they take the baby away for testing, I go with the rest of my drinking family who's there to celebrate with champagne the birth of the child. And we walk across the street to a restaurant and we have drinks. Because the baby's out of me, I'm not going to breastfeed and I can drink now. It's incredible. So her name was Danielle, and she had a hole between the lower chambers of her heart, and it was confirmed that she had Down syndrome. She was a really sick little girl and had multiple health issues, and at 9 months old, I went to her little crib where she was sleeping in the middle of the night, and I picked her up, and she fell back like this. Whoops. She fell back like Raggedy Ann, and her little eyes were rolled back, and she was in a comatose state in her crib. So I rushed her to emergency, and the pediatrician that was on call told me he didn't think she'd make it through the night. And could they take her to Children's? I'm like, absolutely. So they took her in the transport unit to Children's, and I drove. And she remained in that way for 2 months in Children's Hospital in ICU. And I want to talk about a part of the big book and the doctor's opinion that I can relate to this time in my life and this part of my story. About the phenomenon of craving, and when we start to drink, if there's an important engagement to be kept. And the phenomenon of craving becomes paramount. And in my big book, beside the word paramount, I have written more important than anything else. So she's over there in ICU in a medically induced coma at this time. And I'm at home in North Vancouver, and I'm supposed to go see my daughter. And I start to drink. And the phenomenon of craving is so strong that I can't just have one. And then pretty soon, it's paramount, and I can't drive. So I'm going to miss that day. And what I tell myself is, well, she's in a coma, so she's not even going to know I'm there. And that happened over and over and over again. And I'm ashamed to say it, but that's what happens when we're alcoholic, right? So 2 months into the stay, they did a little patch in her heart through the side. It was called a band, so that the blood could move between the lower chambers, and they could get her off of the intubation that she was on. And the tubes came out and stuff, and it was a day that I was going to be able to hold her. So I went over. It was a Sunday morning. I was by myself. And I went over, and I took her out of her little crib, and I held her in my arms, and I started to cry. And I felt right about how I do right now. And the nurse that was on had to come over and ask if I was the mother, because I was so absent from that hospital that they didn't even know who that little girl's mother was. After that stay, I took her home, and she developed cerebral palsy from the loss of oxygen to her brain in that comatose state. So she was mentally and physically handicapped, and I had a very difficult life because I wasn't emotionally equipped to deal with something like that. And I drank, you know, and that little girl, Danielle, my daughter, suffered the brunt of my active alcoholism. She was in my life, and I drove drunk with her in her little car seat, and I went to pediatrician's appointments with booze on my breath from the night before. And I remember one time the physio and occupational therapist were leaving my house, and I had drank wine before they came for the appointment. And I remember sitting in my house afterwards and looking out at them in the driveway, and they were having a conversation, and I was pretty sure they were talking about my drinking. But, you know, I did my best to look after her, and I don't know how she didn't get taken by social services. I'll never know, but I did get to keep her, and I did get separated from alcohol in her little life that she had with me here. So at the peak of my drinking, I had developed insomnia. I couldn't get to sleep, and I couldn't stay asleep. If I got to sleep, I'd wake up, and I couldn't get back to sleep, and it was awful. The only way I could sleep at night was to pass out. So I would set out each day and night to drink myself to sleep. I was a daily drinker for years. I'd wake up in the morning with the shakes, and I'd be throwing up, and I would drink some more to calm my nerves, and the cycle repeated itself over and over and over again, and that's how I lived. So I'm still working in the strip bar, and I fell in love with this guy at work. He just started being really nice to me. He was a bartender. At the time, it felt like he was the only person that ever had faith in me. He used to tell me things like I was a four-leaf clover that had been overlooked before. He told me that I was smart and I didn't know it, and that I had so much potential. He also told me I drank too much. So I tried to stop on my own because he didn't like it, and I was going to just taper off and taper off. And he hooked me up with this counselor in West Vancouver. And I used to go to her all the time, and I would tell her a story about something I did or some big event in my life, probably about Danielle. And she'd go, "Wow, how did that make you feel?" And I'd sit there and go, "I don't know." And I didn't know. She was trying to help me to see that I didn't know how I felt about anything. So then I started to write down a few feelings, so when she asked me that in the next session, I could go, "Well, I felt pain," or "I felt sad," or, you know, and I'd just write a few feelings down so that I could at least come up with a feeling. And she told me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, "Go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Go to a lot of meetings until you find one that feels like home, and join that group, and find yourself a sponsor, and do the 12 steps, and you can recover from alcoholism." And I'd be like, yeah. And she goes, "Promise me before you come next week that you'll have done that." "Oh, yeah. And I'd go the next week, and I think after about three times and I hadn't done that, she wrote down this thing, 16th and Burrard, 10 a.m. Sunday, Kitson, go there. And she hands me this piece of paper. And I went to 16th and Burrard on Sunday because I promised her I would go. And I parked my car and I walked into the basement of this church, and she was sitting in the front row. And there she was. And I still couldn't hear. I mean, I couldn't hear for 8 years, you guys. That was my first meeting. It was 1992. It took me to 2000 to walk up to someone and say, "I'd like to join this group." Because I had this thought that I got this. I can do this on my own. I'm different than you guys, you know? So Bob and I moved to the Okanagan. I married the bartender that thought I had potential. he's a big part of my story. I thought I was a piece of shit, you know? And he's the only person that had faith in me. He's a huge part of my story. He got me into counseling. He got me to the counselor that told me to go to AA, you know? So everything just falls into place exactly the way it's supposed to. So we moved to the Okanagan after we married. We landed right here in Salmon Arm. And can I get you to fill my water? I need it. Thanks. And it was about, we moved here in 94, so I think that year we went to the roundup, because I'd gone to a few meetings here and I'd met a few people, and there was a roundup going on. It was over at the rec center. And we went to the roundup, and it was 1994, and how Bob and I got front row seats, I don't know, but we're sitting in the front row, and there's a little old man up top, and he's up in the front at the mic, and he was funny, and he had this great story, and he was super inspiring. And, oh, that little old guy, he's great, you know. And years later, I was talking to Bob, and I'm like, can you remember our first Alcoholics Anonymous roundup? He goes, yeah, Clancy was the speaker. And, you know, at the time, sitting in the front, no, I didn't know who the little old man at the front of the room was, but he had a great story, and you guys had Clancy as your speaker that year, and he was wonderful. And now I know who Clancy is. He's a circuit speaker, and he's done a lot of great things for Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsored a lot of people, and I think Chuck Chamberlain was his sponsor, and they have a sponsorship lineage kind of thing going on in Southern California. Trish and I were talking about it yesterday, and the Pacific Group, a lot of circuit speakers come out of there, and they have a dress code there. You know, the women come in dresses and skirts to the Pacific Group. My sponsor taught me when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous to dress nicely. She says, you know, we need to show the new people coming through the door that we can recover. So don't come to the meeting with pajama pants on and your hair in a messy bun. Not that I did. But she says we need to clean up, and we need to wear nice clothes when we attend meetings so that people know that we can recover and clean up. It's leading by demonstration. And I've always done that ever since she taught me that. So Bob and I listened to the speaker. We used to go to the Sunday morning sunshine group up at the health center as spectators, not as members. And I remember there was a meeting over in town on Wednesday nights at that time in a little brick building. And it was a smoking meeting. And you could walk in and see the ceiling of smoke. It was probably about 1994 as well. And you guys had a member at that time. His name was Jim Sheridan. And he used to sit with his hands around his coffee mug, and he'd go, so long as you place the spiritual before the material. And he'd sort of have his head down like that when he said it. He was a good old guy. And I don't know if Joe and Bev Am are here, but they were at that Sunday morning sunshine group then. And I remember Bob and I, we decided we were going to get sponsors and do this thing. So we're like, okay, let's go over to Joe and Bev's. And I'm going to ask Bev to sponsor me, and he's going to ask Joe to sponsor him. And we're really going to do this thing now. So, because Bob was alcoholic as well. So we drive out to Joe and Bev's and make the appointment, and we get out there to their place and we have lunch, and I go in a room with Bev and he goes in a room with Joe, and we have our separate visits with those guys, and we come back and thank them for lunch, and we get in the car and we're driving home, and he goes, so did you ask Bev to sponsor you? And I was like, no. Did you ask Joe to sponsor you? He goes, no. And we just didn't. I don't know why. Joe and Bev are wonderful people, but we just, for whatever reason, weren't ready, and that carried on, you know, for a long, long, long time. And I remember going to the Sunday morning sunshine group, and they'd go, let's talk about sponsorship today, and these people are trying to carry a message to me, and I can't hear, you know, I couldn't hear. And they'd say, let's talk about complacency today. And I didn't even know what complacency was. And I would listen to these messages, and I couldn't hear. I just couldn't hear. Because I thought AA was about stopping drinking. I really did. And I was separated from alcohol. I had been for a long time. I was smoking a lot of weed, mind you, in the closet, but I was separated from alcohol. Till someone pointed out to me the words in the title page of our big book, How Many Thousands of Men and Women Have Recovered from Alcoholism? Notice it doesn't say quit drinking. It's a different deal. Think about it. Recovered means I no longer have those symptoms. From alcoholism, what's alcoholism? Well, the book tells me I have a hopeless state of mind and body. So I no longer have the symptoms of the hopeless mind, the behaviors, and the actions that go along with it. So I've recovered from alcoholism. That's a different deal than not drinking. And what I found out was, even though I'm not physically consuming alcohol, it gets worse when I'm not drinking. And I'm powerless if my life's unmanageable. At the time, I also didn't know that the disease centers in my mind. I had no idea. I don't recommend untreated alcohol to anyone, untreated alcoholism to anyone. I suffered for it for a long, long time. I remained a spectator for 8 years, smoking pot to cope. Yeah, you would just find something else to medicate with. You know, if it's not the booze and we're trying to stay right, I just found something else. So I lost my little daughter, Danielle, in 1995. She passed away of pneumonia, and I went through the loss of her while suffering from untreated alcoholism. I didn't have the tools to handle that at that time of my life, and it was another thing that I just stuffed. I just stuffed the feelings of all of those things. When I finally admitted complete defeat, I was a mess. My house was a mess. My marriage was a mess. I had the stack of bills, and I stopped opening them because the next one said, you've missed your last payment, and another one was due. And I know when the third one comes, it's been 90 days, and you're in the credit bureau. And I just stopped opening my mail. I just stopped, and I was in all this fear. I was in my head so bad. Before I walked through the doors of AA, I'd just be in my mind 24/7, and it would just be spinning out of control. And my little boy, Carter, would stand there, and he'd go, Mom, 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 and he couldn't get my attention. And finally, I'd go, Carter, what? And he'd go, I forget what I was going to say. And my kids would act out because they couldn't get my attention in a positive way, so they'd do naughty things to get my attention in a negative way. I like to talk about step one, that alcoholics can take a shit kicking before we're willing to give it up, because that is my story. I mean, we can take a shit kicking over and over and over again, you know? And you know how the book talks about some of, in how it works? Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. You know what my old idea was? That I could recover on my own resources. Hard-headed, right? 8 years to let go of that idea. So I come crawling through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and Armstrong, and I'm like, okay, I'll do that. Steps two and three was what was stopping me. I couldn't imagine what my life would look like. It was the unknown to me, what my life would look like with God in it, and I had prejudgments of what I thought that was going to be. It talks about it all in We Agnostics. That was me, right? I hadn't read the chapter, so I didn't know. So I come in and I look for a sponsor. She greeted me at my first meeting. She was smiling at me at Armstrong with her arms wide open, telling me she's been waiting for me. I used to dodge her at Askew's. I'd see her at the grocery store, and I'd be stoned, and I'd be like, oh my God, there's Laura. So I'd see her, and I'd be like, she hasn't seen me yet, and I'd be like, and I'd go to the next aisle, and she'd see me, and she'd just come right around, hey, Diane, and I was like, oh my God, I'm stoned, and Laura's talking to me. Yeah, I'd run from her. She knew, too. They told me to find a sponsor who has what I want, that I want to be where she's at. So I met her, and she's beautiful on the inside and outside. I loved her message at meetings. I loved watching her talk to her children with such calmness and grace. She had a spiritual light in her that shone bright, and everyone just admired her and respected her. And everything she had, I wanted to be, so I asked her to sponsor me. You know, and I want to tell you something, I still have the same sponsor today, and I still want what she has. Because in the beginning of my talk, I talked about how we grow and we change, and the person I am here today is different than I was 10 years ago, and I'll be different 2 years from now. Well, that's the same for her. She's grown spiritually too, and she's a different woman than she was when I walked through the doors of AA, and I still want what she has, you know? And we hang out together and we talk, and our thinking is along the same lines, and we're just kind of hooked up. And sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, we get to fall in love with our sponsor. And I'm grateful that that happened for me. Some of my first revelations were I used to plan outcomes. I was like the actor that wants to run the whole show that they talk about in step three. And I used to plan outcomes or have assumptions. I remember I'd tell her some big story about something that happened. She goes, "Wow, did they tell you that?" And I go, no, I just know. She's like, "Oh, so you're like a mind reader." It was difficult for me to stop reading minds when I was new. So she took me through the work. She took me through the book. She showed me through the book. And we just did everything it said. You know, you go through, and if it tells you to pray, you pray, and it tells us to write a list of people we harmed, and we made that list, and it tells you to resolutely look for your own mistakes, and we did that, and it tells you to tell it to another person, and we did that, and did the seventh step, and gives you great directions on how to make an amends, and we went through the book, and we did all that, and I changed. I changed. I was a different person. And my life really started to come. I like when Bill describes Abby in the book. He says he's inwardly reorganized. I love those words, right? I think that's a great description. We're inwardly reorganized. And we are. We're different people. Alcoholics Anonymous changes us. So I recovered from alcoholism, my life began to improve, and I had this little business, and it really took off. I'd been spinning my wheels at it before. And what I thought was success at the time, Shannon talked about it this morning, you know, the car and the salary and all of those things. Well, life's really great. I'm getting all this stuff, you know. And I remember going to a meeting in Enderby, and I bought AA Comes of Age, and Mark, he's an old-timer from this district too, Mark came up to me and he says, "Oh, that's a great book." He goes, "Read the part about the reemergence of the ego." And I'm like, "Ouch." okay. You know, and God had me hear that for a reason. It was about to happen to me. 7 years of sobriety, right? And at the time, you don't even know you're doing it, but I'm saying thank you for the help, God. I got this. I can take it from here. And I didn't even know I said it. And you know, Shannon taught today too. We have a length of sobriety, and we have a little bit of a backslide, some of us. And I had a black backslide, and I'm glad I didn't drink over it, but I got back into selfishness and self-centeredness. And I made choices at that time in my life that cost me my marriage. And the separation of my family, and my kids were put through a year of change that they did not bring on, and it was a really difficult time. I thank God I didn't drink during that time. I was only going to my home group. I didn't have a service. I finished up a roundup committee service position at that time, and then I didn't do any service for a couple of years. And I came crawling through the doors of the morning meeting in Vernon. And I started to revisit step three, and I'll tell you what, the step three in the big book is one of my favorite portions of the big book today, because it describes describes for me selfishness perfectly. And I know because of examining myself over and over that selfishness is at the root of my problems. It's at the root of my character defects. It's at the root of a lot of stuff. It's ego. And I studied that, how it manifests in our lives with that great metaphor of how the actor wants to run the whole show, how I think I know how you should be, how I know how you should treat me, or how you should act or react. And I caught myself, not just in actions, but in my thinking, and I would sit and examine my thinking. And I learned how to get on my knees and say the third step prayer. And when I say, "Relieve me of the bondage of self," those things I kept finding, I would be giving them to God. And I did that so much because I had to. I was in so much pain at that time. And I just kept surrendering self. And one of the things I learned about the third step prayer at that time is because I was doing it so often is I could get on my knees and kind of rattle off a prayer and think about something else at the same time. And I think that's why in the book it talks about when we sincerely took supposition. And I learned how to do a little meditation before I start to pray to really center myself so that when I pray, I'm saying the words and I'm meaning it. I also revisited step 10 in the big book in the 12 and 12, and I love the 12 and 12 where it talks about when I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. And anytime I'm disturbed, and I still do this today, I do 10-step work daily, because anytime something's pushing my buttons, I need to just look at myself. It's almost like in Alcoholics Anonymous, we take our eyeballs out, and instead of looking out at everybody else, we turn them around and we look inside. And it's the only way I can recover. It's the only way I can get right with God. And if I'm disturbed, I'm not right with God. I'm connected to God when I'm at peace. And I'm right here, right now with you guys. And that's been my experience. And that's the place I like to be. I like what Chuck Chamberlain talks about. He talks about our rigorous honesty and our self-appraisal. There's a speaker I really enjoy. His name's Sandy Beach, and he talks about it too. He said, and I think it comes from Chuck Chamberlain, uncover, discover, discard. Uncover what it is, discover what it's about, and discard it through prayer. That's what I use prayer for. I use prayer to discard what I find isn't working, mostly in my thinking, really. I have a great life today. I have an incredibly great life. It's full of people. It's full of friends from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think it's, Dick talked about it in his talk today, I think that in the 12 steps that we lead by demonstration. And it talks about us, that in our step 3 prayer, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with thy power, thy love, and thy life. And it also talks about in step 7, every single defect of character that stands in my way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Step 12 talks about having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And I heard a speaker one time, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you notice it doesn't say meetings. We have a spiritual experience. And that's the message, that I'm a different woman today than when I came in as a result of the steps. And practice the principles in all our affairs. I take that super seriously. The 23 hours a day that I'm not here in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 23 hours a day that I'm out there when I'm at work, when I'm at the grocery store, when I'm driving my car, when I'm with my family. Those are the 23 hours a day that I really work and practice purity. That comes from the Oxford Group's purity. I love purity. I'm pure at heart. You know, I'm joyful. I've released to God the things that are blocking me from being spiritual. I'm practicing purity. I'm practicing the steps. And for me, the meeting place is where we talk about that. My sponsor taught me when I was new that the spirit of tradition 5, that the meeting place is where we carry a message. We take our problems to our sponsors and we bring the solution to the meeting. So the meeting's where I share what I do for the 23 hours out there. Not where I come and pretend I'm on my best behavior and then go out the door and be a jerk. You know, it's not like that. And it's not like that today for me. I take it really serious. And I found that we get what we put into it. I talked to lots of girls about that. We get what we put into it 100% of the time. I learned about the service structure in AA through holding different service positions. I love Alcoholics Anonymous service positions. Each one sets us up for the next one. And Trish and I were talking earlier today, like the learning never stops, right? It just never stops. And we go through these different service positions and we learn and we learn and we learn and we keep learning. I'm grateful for the people that served before us. I'm grateful for the people that set up the service structure that have served before us that we can lean on and learn from. And if I have a question, I can call somebody up that served in that position before and ask them for some help or some direction and how to handle a situation. One of the reasons I take service so passionately is because somebody else served in that position. Somebody else served as GSR before I did. Somebody else served as DCM before I did. Somebody else was on the PI committee before I was. And as far as I'm concerned, it's my turn to sit in that seat and that seat and that seat and that seat. It's part of the unity that service director was there for me when I walked through the doors. And it's my responsibility to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous in that way. And that's just the way I feel about it. And I take it super seriously, and I've met a lot of fantastic people. So in closing, I want to talk about miracles. The dictionary says it's a surprising event. It's not explicable by natural or scientific laws, and is therefore considered a work of the divine. So, miraculous. Can't explain it. Alcoholics of our type that sober up, that's a miracle. That's a miracle as far as I'm concerned. We're not supposed to be sober, but we are. Gathered together, there's this power, there's a spirit here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're genuinely happy to see another person get this thing. You ever notice in the sobriety countdown that the applause gets louder and louder as the time of sobriety gets shorter and shorter? That the 1 year people get more applause than the 10 year people? And the 1 day person, we explode into a standing ovation for the person with 24 hours that's here at the roundup. It's because we sincerely want to see other alcoholics receive the same miracle that we've received. I love AA. I really do. Now I want to share with you what the world thinks of AA. So I have this book written by Time Magazine. I brought it with me today. It's a book written by Time. And it's titled 80 Days That Changed the World. And there's Ted Kennedy or JFK and his wife, there's Elvis Presley, and they're walking on the moon. Big, huge events in the last 100 years. It's from 1901 to 2001. The most important days, 80 of them. So the people that wrote that wanted to search for in 100 years. So if you take 365 days in a year and you times it by 100, that's a lot of years, that's a lot of days. What are the most 80 important days? If you turn to page 25 of that book, there's a story about an alcoholic stockbroker from New York. He meets an Akron physician. The broker's on a business trip to Ohio. You guys know the story. But for the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous on Mother's Day 1935, being one of the most 80 most important days in the world in the last 100 years, that's incredible. That's what the world thinks of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Well, I think AA is incredible. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know for sure that everything good in my life today is because of God, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the fellowship. It's been a privilege to come up here and share with you guys today, and I want to thank you for the opportunity. Thanks.